key conversation on the role of creativity in instructional technology. How's that? I didn't use the word symposium or panel, just conversation. So that, we, that means we can call it the second interview. Fred Hokanson is my co-conspirator in proposing this and putting it together this year. We had a lot of great input from our other guests. So Brad is here with me, and then our other panelists participating today, whom I'm really thrilled just to have, be able to have this conversation with, are Brett Wilson, Patrick Parrish, and our conference keynote speaker, Stephen Downs. Rob Branch and Susan Daniels are on the program for our panel, and they are both sent their greetings and regrets this morning. Rob, in Rob's case, he was actually spelled two different ways by the ACT conference planners, and they put both of him in two different places this morning. So that was discovered a little bit late in the game, he knows that I miss having his voice with us. Susan is from California State, close by, and called me this week reporting that she was housing some colleagues in her home who've been evacuated from the fires, and fires are very close to her house as well, but so far she was okay, and they're just dealing with a lot this week, and it didn't really make sense for her to plan on why we bring in this morning. But anyway, so we're going to get started on this topic. We have our panel, we have a theme, and we have a handout for you, which I hope you've found, that consists of a one-page contribution from each of us.
I think there's a static right here,
Our facilitator's name is TBA, and we've been keeping an eye out for TBA this morning, but we probably need to ask for a volunteer to do some of TBA's work for us, particularly toward the conclusion of the session. Is there someone among us who thinks you might be able to? Thank you so much. Okay, so what we're going to do is begin with a brief opening comment from each of our panelists, and then we're just going to open up the conversation and hope to really involve you in the conversation as time goes on. We have 75 minutes to work with here. Of course, that's ticking away. So I just want to go ahead and begin by saying that when I came back to graduate school in instructional technology, I took a design and development tools course as an elective in our studio program at the University of Georgia. And I was really struck by what I saw among my peers, the projects they were doing. I saw things that were really aesthetically eye-catching, and I saw things that were downright clever. And that's really stuck with me from that semester. And as I got further looking at what I wanted to do my dissertation research on, I kept going back to that. And so I started doing literature search on creativity in instructional technology. I thought I would see what's out there, because I was also beginning to study theories of creativity and really taking an interest in that. And to my surprise, I found that there really wasn't any research on that topic specifically, although there were some other contributions that people had done, but they were studying something else rather than studying creativity specifically. And so I began to work on that and just ended up creating a kind of conceptual model, because one of the other things I found is that creativity really isn't talked about in our ID models on the whole. It's not represented in the visualization of instructional design that we have these many different versions of. So I thought to myself, well, let's, if we had a model that did include creativity, what would it be? And there's a little representation of that in your handout. I think I'm over 3 minutes, so I'm going to let the next panelist give their opening statement. That's right, we'll come back at the end and do Susan and Rob.
Is that Susan first?
Well, yeah, okay, as you wish, Dr. Wilkinson.
I'm going to be channeling Susan Davis here because that'll be a little less effective, I guess. But the reason I'm doing that is because I met Susan about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and I was discussing creativity with her, that I taught creativity, and she says, how do you do testing? And she is a long-time experienced person in teaching creativity. She talks about, in her statement, she talks about the four P's of creativity, which are sort of the standard understanding of creativity. And she gets into the part about whether or not we have some very specific creative people that are there are people that we know are creative. You know, everybody exemplifies Einstein as creative, and probably if you gave Einstein an iPod, we'd have all of our creativity and innovation on one spot, and we'd be a lot handier. But what we'd like to do is actually get to the realization saying that everybody has some sort of capability of creativity, and she actually discusses that in her statement. The question of whether you can train people to be creative is something I think we both share an idea on, and probably the rest of you share a hope for, is that yes, you can train people in terms of creativity, and you can test for it. So, as she says, central to the basis of education and psychology is the question of whether creativity can be taught. In other words, paralleling similar questions related to intelligence, is creativity the result of nurture or nature? Similarly, the answer that best fits that we know at this time is both and rather than either or, which seems to come up a lot. And of course, the architects in the crowd would say, you know, it's rather mature creative at that point, and in architecture, too. But I guess I would say that she brings, and I guess I would hope to substitute for her in terms of the capability and understanding that creativity is a measurable skill. I present a research on that, and generally the research does say that you can increase certain measures of creativity, whether those measures of creativity or measure are valid or not is another question. My analogy that I always say is, can you teach people French? And you can measure that people know French after they've taken the course, and I can do exactly the same thing in terms of creativity, and Susan can as well. So that's, I'll try to fill in for her in terms of some measured aspects.
Okay. Well, this being a conversation and all, I'll keep my comments brief if I can. And I won't kind of exactly repeat what I said on the hearing page handout, but there is one point I want to emphasize. Many of us were trained or are very familiar with information processing models of cognition. I used to teach an ed psych class, and over and over I would teach basic ideas of long and short-term memory and so forth. I read an article, I think it was a 1990 article by Donald Shum, the guy who did the reflective practice model, and he talked about how models of information processing were good at talking, you know, as understanding where thoughts and memory or whatever, where things went, stages and flow and processing of that. They weren't good at talking about where ideas came from in the first place. And if you think about that, do you know of any cognitive explanation for where ideas come from? I'd be interested, but I don't think the mechanistic models that we have of cognition don't explain the origin or start of ideas. And of course that goes back to Plato, the kind of the paradox of how does anything new, truly new, get acquired or understood in us. It's not an easy problem to address. I recall the early models of cognition, of information processing models that I saw. I think Richard Atkinson and other people like that model, they would put up a box, sometimes unconnected to the processing steps or stages of their model. maybe wave that we should up and down arrows, vaguely suggesting that called executive control.
Yeah.
And executive control was what? It was kind of saying, well, this is where, this is who kind of really is in charge. This is the part of us that drives or directs or manages the whole system. And again, well, where does that come from? Where is it? How is it that we have this core self that manages our thinking? It's not at all clear to the psychologist. And I guess I'm kind of trying to differentiate or to emphasize the need to understand something apart from the psychology models or the traditional scientific views of our practice. Our practice is very heavily based on psychology, and again, those side of things are not well understood. The field of instructional design grew up historically of an ambition to articulate a set of rules, a contingency rules, that would say when and where to apply what instructional strategies based on what kind of model you hold, what kind of goals you're seeking, and so forth. That rule-based vision of practice has limitations. You can only take it so far. Because the complexity of the world trumps whatever system of rules we could ever think of. So what do you do when you get to the end of your rules? Your theory is always going to be underspecified. I use the term, I got that from Dave Johnson, underspecified when it comes to really making it happen in the real world. And so then what do you do? And I think maybe that's an invitation for us to consider. This is an invitation that I see to say, well, let's use the term creativity and see if we can start talking about that huge gap of making things happen in the real world that we value and to make excellent instruction. So that's a starting point.
Good morning. It may be a little early to be coherent, so you may have to be a little creative in putting together my comments here. I'm interested in creativity as it's manifested in everyone. I know we usually use creative in a normative sense. We say that person is creative, that they have exceptional creativity. But I'd like to explore that by looking at, you know, where that comes from and how that exists in all of us. So it's a non-normative sense. And I suggest that creative acts are the decisions that we make when we have unlimited possibilities. There's no rules to go by. There might be guidelines, but essentially at some point you have to employ your imagination to play out potential outcomes of what decision you make. And that it's this imagination that's the mechanism. It's not much of an explanation that Brent is looking for, but imagination is that place where we pull in elements of experience and we watch them play out. So it's like a little theater in our minds, perhaps, where we see what the outcomes are of elements of our experience. I'm not looking at a psychological source. Brent suggested not doing that, and I agree with that. I'm looking at a philosophical source to explain creativity and imagination. And my favorite philosophical source is John Dewey. He does offer some good solutions here, or at least some good directions. In the imagination, I mentioned that it's like a little theater there. Quite often, rather than rationality, where we have logical rules that help us make a decision, that help us tie things together, there might be a narrative logic. We watch the story unfold. And Dewey described this as dramatic rehearsal. And particularly when we're talking about the impacts on people, we watch how the decisions we're making will play out among the people that it would impact. And at first, the people might include ourselves. If we make a decision, what's our future life going to be like? I'm going beyond 3 minutes, but I'll be quicker.
Phenomenal.
Okay. I suggest that in ID, we do need an exceptional quantity of creativity because we have myriad unlimited possibilities in the decisions we make. If you just think about it, at the beginning of a project, you have to analyze the situation. But how do you know that you've analyzed enough of the realities of the situation, that you've got enough data there? How do you know when you've considered enough potentials, where this project could lead? And how do you know which of these might be important to the people there? In the end, when you're developing materials, you have to think about things like, what are the varieties of ways people might interpret this material that you're developing? What means could they derive from going through these materials? Obviously, the possibilities are endless, and you can't use rules to come to any decisions about that. So what we do use is something called empathy. And I think empathy is a critical kind of imagination. It's a social use of imagination where we, you know, allow those events to play out through that dramatic rehearsal to see what might be the results of the decisions we make. And I think that instructional design is particularly critical because the audience that we are creating materials for or teaching to are put in very vulnerable situations, and we have to be very empathetic to their concerns. There's the potential failure every step of the way, and so we have to be very cautious about the decisions we make and be very empathetic with their situation. Thanks.
I got the big coffee this morning. Whoever, you probably drank it already. First they held this at 8 a.m., and then they put it at the very end of the maze, and then they moved to the room. Here's my talk now. I've scribbled all over it. When I originally wrote this, what I wanted to do is try to get across the idea that creativity is, first of all, not something that is magic, and secondly, something that everybody has the capacity to do, although it may require some particular sorts of skills. And from that light, I broke down the, if you will, creative process, and I'm sensitive to the fact that a discussion of creativity is as much a discussion of the definition of the word as a theoretical exploration of a topic, but I don't want to linger on the definition so much. But I'm thinking about then the creative process, properly so called, which to my mind breaks down into two major aspects. The first aspect is experience, and the second aspect is the set of possibilities that are afforded to you, or as I put in the paper, what the tools allow you to do. I look at this paper, I think I'm a little bit too tool-centered, and that's why I've got a lot of scribbling here. When we look at these two things, and the first thing, I think we see evidence of the role of experience across the creative spectrum. I put a couple of examples in there. I put Bruce Sterling, for example, who very noticeably, because he documents his work quite well, traveling around the world looking for ideas of his novels. And I remember reading quite a long description from him, just a non-fiction description of the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus, which I found fascinating. And it wasn't any surprise to me to find that very same Turkish Republic of North Cyprus showing up in his novels. Similarly, Arthur C. Clarke, drawing on his experiences in Sri Lanka to create his novel, Palms of Paradise. And we see that quite a bit. We see that the creative process is indeed rooted in experience. So we think of, or we can think of, experience, whatever that amounts to, as the raw materials for creativity. And just as an aside, and I don't want to get into this in any sort of detail, I think that experience itself is a learned thing. I think there's plenty of evidence for that. We see, for example, how a person can learn how to taste different flavors of wine. I am not one of those, so I speak from description. I'm a beer drinker, although not sour in the morning. Or how an artist can perceive different shades of color. And of course, as you pulled the old thing, we're doing some redecoration in the home, and I said, well, do you want this? And Andrea says, well, I want white. And I bring out some white, and she says, no, that's not what I need. And of course, there's white, there's ivory, there's cream. The experienced eye can see the difference between these things, and my eye sees white. So I think that there are ways of improving our experiences. There are ways of understanding how to become better experiencers. I was thinking when I wrote this, I once wrote an article called Educational Blogging. And educational blogging is all about how to use blogging and learning. And the first thing that I said people should do is that they should read. And the idea here, again, is to teach yourself how to experience. If you read blogs over and over and over and over, you become more attuned to it. Somebody remarked, and it was at this conference, I forgot who it was, they said, we learn this stuff in school at an early age, and then we forget about it. But even though we've forgotten about it, what we learn still informs how we see the world later on. And I believe that that's true. I think there's, on the one hand, there's learning, you know, remembering the facts. The other thing is learning the shaping of the mind, and it's the shaping of the mind that informs how we experience. So I could go on a long discussion about how to experience. I think that's an important component. But the second part of this is the possibilities afforded to us by our tools. There's going to be some talk about cognition and cognitive theory and all of that, but in fact, possibility is the domain of logic. And my education in possibility does not come from psychologists at all or educational theorists at all. It comes from people like David K. Lewis, from people like Robert Stelmacher, people who study modal logic, the logic of possibility and necessity, and counterfactual logic. You think about a statement like brakeless trains are dangerous, and that actually goes back to the Russell Strassinger days. How do you know that brakeless trains are dangerous? There are no brakeless trains. Because if they made brakeless trains, they would be really dangerous. Right? So here we have this thing. We all know that this is true, yet none of us has experienced it. And the way we know it's true now is going to fall into the domain of possibility and necessity. We know that in certain ways of looking at things, if there were a brakeless train, it would be dangerous. Well, how do? We create what are called possible worlds. There are all kinds of different ways of creating possible worlds. Somebody just talked about empathy. Empathy is a way of creating a possible world. It's a type of projection. If you look again at the philosophy of mind, how do you know that there are minds in other people's heads? Because strictly speaking, you have no access to that information. You have no way of knowing for sure. Strictly speaking, you could all be automatons. This could all be a dream. And philosophers think like that. It's terrible. So we have to go through this process where we have a picture of what the world is. And that picture of the world includes brains that think, and includes brains that feel and have emotions. And typically, we project those emotions from ourselves. And we could go into the whole psychological literature of projection and things like that, but I won't go there. What I want to do, though, is to point out that although we talk about a logic of possible worlds and a logic of projection, first of all, there is no such single logic. I'm reminded of Susan Hack, whose book is entitled Philosophy of Logics, plural. There is no, we represent, you know, there's just one state of the world, but there are multiple ways of looking at the world, multiple interpretations of possibility, of probability, and risk. And secondly, it's not even clear to me that logic, properly so called, is the way to understand possible worlds, because we come back to this whole thing about rules. Logic, as we understand it now, is about rules. It's about axioms and derivations from those rules. However, there are other ways of looking at the world. If you will, the logic of similarity or the logic of patterns. And there has been some work done in that. Amos Tversky, for example, did work in the logic of similarity, although it all ends up looking a lot like the logic of counterfactuals. But I believe that if we had an understanding of how patterns cascade through networks, if we had a logic of understanding that, that would give us a means of mapping out what for any given individual is the set of possible worlds. And it is from that set of possible worlds that we get creativity. I know I'm over time, so thank you.
And finally, I just want to represent Rob Branch's contribution to our pool of one-page reflections on creativity. And the essence of what Dr. Branch brings to the table is the belief that's there in his title. It's the last page in your handout. And I hope the handouts have found their way to all of you. So they're just stacking them up here near the door. But it's that the systematic design of instruction promotes creativity. And so Dr. Branch's contention, and he goes through a little bit of how we visually represent the instructional design process, and he advocates more of a curvilinear way of looking at the different pieces of that process as being a little more true to life. But just the idea that it isn't the instructional design process itself that lacks creativity. It is, generally where either the models or the practice of instructional design or research about instructional design that have fallen short of the mark of that creative ideal. So that's kind of the essence of where Dr. Branch would come from on this topic. And I want to say also that we conceived of this from the beginning as being really open to the whole of instructional technology, because I believe there's lots of room for creativity in our efforts in technology integration in the schools, in all the different things that instructional technologists do. As it happens, my focus is more on instructional design, and most of our panelists really focus on that. So I think a lot of what we are talking about so far is instructional design itself, but I just want to acknowledge that there is a broader field of instructional technology that can certainly be a part of the conversation. Okay. I'm going to sit down at this point.
You need these tools.
Yes.
There you go. Well, we, Brad and I just plan to try to facilitate things a little bit here, and there's some things that have been laid out on the table, and there's, of course, a good bit more detail in the handout than what we've been able to say briefly. But I want to perhaps ask something to Stephen at the moment, and you know, when we talk about that there isn't, you don't really get something from nothing.
Right.
That there's really a, and you described in your keynote address how really the idea of a network and that our thinking is made up in some way that no one has figured out yet, but of networks, of patterns, and so on. And that there's a finiteness to that that seems to be compelling. So we, on the other hand, a lot of people in creativity, I think, really cling to the notion that, well, do we really know that we can't get something from nothing? Don't creative ideas really seem to come out of the blue? And I just wondered if you could talk about that a little bit more, and maybe Brent, you might have something on that as well.
There's a whole set of arguments that are based on this something from nothing argument
I mean, again, in philosophy, you go back to, like, you know, Aquinas' proofs for the existence of God. There has to be a first cause, because causation can't come from nothing. And the fields of linguistic and psychology are informed by Chomsky, who writes about what he calls the poverty of the stimulus. And because what we seem to come up with, things like, as you said, universals, and I go through the range of things, categories, seem to be not present in experience. And in philosophy, this has been handled through an examination of what has come to be called the problem of induction. And the problem of induction is basically, how do you get to an infinite, like a law of nature, Newton's laws, whatever, from finite premises? And strictly speaking, you can't. And so it appears, and often has appeared, that we do get something from nothing. And the epiphenomenal effect of that is our sense of, I have no idea where that came from. It just popped out of nowhere. And again, it appears to be we're getting something from nothing. And I think we need to understand this differently. And this is, in fact, the investigation that actually led me to the direction that I ended up in. Because traditional logic, you know, it's 2,000 years of trying to solve the problem. I've concluded, along with many others, you're not going to solve it. You're not going to get infinites. You're not going to get categories, etc., from finite premises. So we need to reconceive, reimagine what we mean when we talk about infinities or categories. And the way I approached it, and I'm not sure if I'm unique in this or not, I know Tversky's done some work in it, but is to, instead of thinking of a category or a universal as a linguistic entity and therefore an atomic statement and therefore indivisible, rather I perceived it as, if you will, a pattern of perception. Now, what I mean by that is, take, say, cat. What a cat is actually, no, it's not a word, it's not a concept. Imagine it in your mind's eye, a whole bunch of dots. Dot, 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 dot. Because when you look at a cat, that's what you're getting, right? You're getting, on your neural, on your retina, you're getting a whole bunch of impulses, and your brain's going, dot, 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 right? And that's what it is. So, okay, so now we have a concrete perception of a cat. Now, what happens if we start taking some of those dots away? And now we got duck, 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 right? So we got a less concrete cat. And this is where similarity comes from, is you have one perception of a cat and another perception of a cat, and you start taking dots away, and the two sets of dots that remain overlap to a certain significant degree. And it's the mathematics of this overlap that Tversky looks at. But as you keep taking things away, what you're doing is creating, if you will, blank spaces in the dots. And that is what is creating the range of possibilities. So now, getting something from nothing actually amounts to taking what you have and taking away from it. And eventually, if you take everything away, you get nothing. And if you take everything except one dot away, you get existence, which is getting a little too metaphysical for me. But that's how that process, to me, has to work. Because it can't work the other way. It doesn't work the other way. So if we understand mental phenomena cognitively, as sentences, propositions, you can't get from there to the sorts of things that we see, like creativity. And it's from that foundation that I draw the rest of my speculations.
That sounds a lot like the point that you made, Brent, that we've had these mechanistic kind of approaches, and it doesn't seem like we can get from that.
Yeah, in short, what I'm hearing, I think I'm looking at it in a qualitative way, and you know, Stephen is looking more at the quantitative logic. So when he talks about logics of possibility, it's a formalization of what animals do without a whole lot of quantification. But they can still see where they're going and run pretty fast. Mm-hmm. It's just a different take. I would like to relate the discussion right now
with Pat's comments about limitless, thinking of creativity in some kind of open, limitless way. I tend to think quite the reverse. I mean, I used to use an old quote from Rollo May, and I forgot to bring it. But basically, he says creativity happens with, you can't have it without constraints. You have some problem, you have to get around this mountain. You have some things to work with, and then you exercise some creative act. And I like that idea that, yeah, it's the tool, it's the, what is the biggest constraint we face? It's kind of, I mean, here's a thought about that. It's reality, It's the things we bump into. It's the things we bump against. It's the, have you ever had a wonderful design and then you go check it out in reality and it didn't quite work the way you thought? Well, that reality check is the constraint. It's the ultimate constraint that we all face in our, we have intentions, we have wonderful possibilities, and then we go try it out with students and the bombs, or we're taught something about how to do it better. So what our end, yesterday somebody mentioned in our conversations about aesthetics that the method follows the medium. Well, what does that mean? Method follows the medium. An artist who's working in oils will have his or her method dictated to a large extent by the qualities of those oils. Right? If you're a filmmaker, and what have you got? You've got this kind of camera, you've got, your method is going to cope with and adapt to the tool that you've got, the medium that you're working in. What's the language of my medium? And so for instructional designers, what's our medium? What's our oil? Well, we've got a certain set of tools to use and so forth. Those resources, those tools open up and close up possibilities. There's affordances and constraints based on all of these tools that we have. Therein lies our creativity space. We call it problem space. You want to think more in terms of problem solving. But that's the space in which we can move around and do some interesting things. So any response from Pat on that would be interesting to him.
Yeah, I've appeared to paint myself into a corner.
One
way out is to start the other direction with a different color. I won't resort to that. It doesn't take too many variables, too many possibilities for the options to become limitless, at least to our small minds. And so, reality is, that's a lot of variables.
Sure.
And so I think that perhaps limitless in an absolute sense may be a wrong word, but I think from a human sense, that's still there. And I think that one of our ways out of that is to create constraints. So part of the creative process is posing constraints into the decisions we're going to make. As instructional designers, we were talking about it yesterday, we generate solutions, and then we test those solutions, I would suggest, through this dramatic rehearsal to see how they might play out and how effective they might be in the situation we're faced with. So, yes, constraints are important, and constraints are probably our only way out, but I still would suggest that those constraints come from an unlimited number.
Okay, so if I'm hearing, one way to think about it is the cycle of not novel idea generation and testing and acceptance or pursuit starts with your own head. You're saying, hey, this is cool, I think this will work, and you think it through and you show some empathy, think in empathic terms, and do some dramatic rehearsal, and you say, nope, that won't work because I can foresee, I can imagine such and such. So you correct yourself, self-censorship. The next step might be, hey, you and I are talking, and I pitch an idea, and you say, I don't think that'll work, Brent, because of such and such. And then we look for another rub. And then once you and I agree, as a design team, what's the next step? Well, we create it and try it out on students, and then they tell us, no, it's not... That's not, and so that cycle
of idea generation and tryout is a repeating cycle in various forms of implementation. And I'm trying to show similarity between our own thinking, our social thinking, and our butting up against reality, that external reality. And as far as one of the main constraints we face is our own bodies, our own mortality. That's a huge constraint. It's a huge human issue that all of this creativity happens through our bodies. Because we are embodied creatures, we have a sense of behindness in front of, and below, and location, and all this kind of stuff. And it affords us to do certain things. It also constrains us in many serious ways. So.
Gentlemen, I want to call on Brad here, not only because it's his turn to talk, but also because I inadvertently passed over Brad. He spoke on behalf of Susan at the beginning, and I did not turn back over to him for his own statement at the beginning of our conversation. So, Brad, my friend, please forgive me and talk.
Kind of fit in a little bit more. That's what's going on. One of the things in terms of this whole line of discussion, as you're sitting here, and the question that I was at a conference last week, and the thing came up, and it said, there are 16 million different variations of this conference. And that was a very small conference. You had 16 million choices, but you could have 16 different variations in terms of your whole experience. And your experiences here probably are somewhere in the range of the possibility of, say, 200 million different choices that you could have done, and that doesn't include what you had at the bar last night. And so the real question that I have for you that I think may start focusing our discussion back in instructional design is, why are you guys here? Because we all had to be here. But none of you did. I don't owe any of you money, I don't think, and I don't think you owe me money. And the question, the only thing that I could get to in terms of trying to put this together was that I think we have a recognition within the field. Either we want to be amused on Friday morning, which is a good one.
Mm-hmm. Not at 8 in the morning.
Or the other idea might be that we recognize that there's something that's inherently needed in instructional design in terms of creativity. Something needs to happen and something needs to change. The constraints that we impose on the field, or the constraints the field makes, force something that is not creative, that is inherently not creative. And I guess I'm in the world of infinite possibilities or 16 million chances or something like that, 60 million chances to have the right conference. The question is, how do we move forward in terms of what we're doing with creativity? And I guess the other observation I had that was past that was that as we move forward, what's happening in the world that I've seen, aside from, I teach a little class on creative problem solving, and I test these people on creativity, and I'm right about that neuron to neuron level before they come up with a new idea, and I can say, that person's more creative than the other. I do what Susan Daniel talks about. On the opposite end of what's happening in terms of society today, society is changing where not only do we make things that are interesting for people, we make things that are interesting for people that they can change. And where innovation and creativity are going to move is we're going to be making things for people that companies are going to be needing to make things that make people more creative. Because creativity is moving away from the corporate boardroom. Creativity is moving away from the corporate design lab, and it's being distributed. So that now, of course, you can walk out and you can buy a car. My wife bought a car, and she customized the car that she bought. And, she's a suburban white woman. She bought this Scion XB, and it is her car, and she kind of loves that car because it is her exact car, but the only detail to it. And I keep walking, I said, why don't you get the big woofers in the back? And she said, no, I got big enough woofers already. don't step on that joke. But we have this understanding that creativity is inherently good. I think there's a rule in the process for creativity. But in the end, I think one of the things that may be happening in terms of society is we'll be moving to something that is maybe a step past constructivism, a step where we have to make the learner, engage the learner, connect the learner, and kind of convince the learner to be more creative about their education. So it's how do you go further? How do you make the end user, how do you get the end user to be more creative, to be more intelligent, to be more learned in terms of what they're doing? And I don't really know how to do that. And I really do think it connects back to all of what we've been talking about, is how do we pull that step out of the thing that you stop in your own mind, that's a bad idea, or the thing that she stops because she thinks it's a bad idea, to be very honest, I guess. Or the thing that the rest of you stops. That I think one of the things I've been saying also is that creativity is getting to be this a logic, a form of logic, a logic diffuser or something like that, is that you're always having to be creative in your argument form as opposed to that little conception that people
I'd be interested in talking more about how that user creativeness or learner creativeness can be scaffolded and supported to help it happen. But I also thought it might help if I, what I didn't really say in my opening comments was that my contention that's in my model is that there are design problems, large and small, throughout the entire instructional design process. And those design problems are opportunities for creative thinking. And I don't expect that any of us will come up with a real new idea at every little obstacle we encounter in our instructional design work. But I think that it's there embedded in the process, that there's a lot of room for creativity in instructional design. Ultimately, it seems like where we're trying to go is, I see two possible things. Are we trying, as Brad said, do we see something overall that needs to change, an innovation that needs to happen in our field in a macro level, or is it that we just need our field to wrestle more and be engaged more with creativity? And what do you think about that? So I see that's sort of two different lines of thought.
Just really quick, my opening statement was suggesting that we just need to recognize the creativity that's already there and acknowledge it.
Steve?
Yeah. There is a tendency and a temptation, and it's even been exhibited on this panel, to confuse between the creative process and the scientific process. And a certain amount of what has been already described as creativity falls under what I would call the heading of scientific method. When we talk about being up against reality and things like that, the description that followed was the classic description of the hypothetical deductive method, where you come up with a proposition and then you test it against reality, and then it's either confirmed in that sample or it's falsified and that's pauper. And the problem with that is that failed, and it failed for a number of reasons. First of all, confirmation and falsification don't actually lead you to theory, which is a real weakness in a model that's supposed to lead you to theory. And secondly, it doesn't explain at all where you come up with these propositions to test in the first place. So any discussion of the testing or evaluation of it is going to fall, in my mind, outside the domain of discussion. It's going to fall outside the realm of creativity. Once we have an idea and we're testing it and things like that, now we're into something called science.
And that would be the Graham Wallace's stages of creativity that he proposed, that would correspond to the final stage, which is the elaboration, verification of working with the idea from that point.
And the word verification, again, comes straight from logical positivism.
Right. If your goal is to create models and theories, scientific models and theories, then yes, you're into science. But if you're into design, you're not doing science.
Well, this is the interesting thing, right? Because if we look at our literature, we see two kinds of papers, right? We see the creative papers, and then we see the scientific papers. And how many of the talks that you've already seen here. Somebody had an idea, went out, tested it, measured four students, saw what the results were, etc. They're doing something
they're
like...
They're doing science.
They're doing science.
Yeah. And that's something different from design. Now, the processes of checking with reality, yeah, that there are similar processes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, an artist does art. An artist doesn't do science. But do they bump up against reality? Yes, they do. And they work within the constraints that they have got. So not everything that is reality-based is science. And so, you know, I just don't... And that's one of the confusions that we do have in our field, is that we tend to generalize the science way beyond what it really is done, what really it is. And so, yes, once in a while, people in our field do science. It's an exceptional activity, but it does get done. But a lot of the time, we're doing something else. We're doing contextualized reasoning. We're doing localized situational problem solving, and whether it's design activity, whether it's production activity, whether it's engagement with various kinds of things. Yeah, we do a whole lot of that. What tends to happen is we value science so highly as a privileged activity that we want to extend the construct as far as we can get and make it go so that we can cover ourselves and say, oh, I'm a scientist. And I think we've got to back off a little of that and say, no, it's a part of what we're interested in, but really, we're in a applied field, we're in a professional field of practice. We draw on science. We use a lot of science ideas, notions that come from that kind of exercise. But only once in a while do we really do it ourselves in any kind of systematic real way. That's my opinion, but, you know.
It almost seems like you're getting to the point that there's a non-scientific logic or a non-scientific generative mental capability that needs to occur that's valuable. And generally we identify that as creativity.
And or the design process. Or design. Or
yes.
Yes. maybe we should try that.
I'm anxious to hear people's responses or extending out. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Questions for the panel.
Yeah, I was just going to tell Stephen that that quote about education was actually B.F. Skinner. He said, an education is what remains after what has been taught has been forgotten. And it's kind of ironic because people would think of Skinner, who was very much a behaviorist, a strict behaviorist pretty much at that, to be someone who would be a proponent of creativity. And yet, if you read his book, Technology of Teaching, inside of it, he talks about how we can use program instruction to foster creativity. And these are more pragmatic, so I think you guys have been dealing a lot with academic discussion of creativity, but I mean, as an instructor, when I go into a room to teach something like computer animation, it's almost like baking a cake. And you put in these ingredients, and is it by magic the reality that Brent discussed just appears? I mean, it's like an emergent property that seems to sort of happen. And so I was sort of hoping that we'd be more pragmatic in terms of, like, you know, what my mission is to do that. And, you know, if you're going to, I mean, I think that artists don't bump into reality. I think they embrace it and they swim in it. I don't think it's anything that they bump into. And I think a transcendent state, if you're going to work beyond reality, you have to move to transcendent states. And I think we're more into pragmatic.
It does take a little bit of a dialectic, a little alternating. You go into your little private world of imagination, and then you go back into the real world. Sometimes it's just me being a professor.
I have no idea, I mean, I guess I can substantiate it by saying, it, you know, why is it, where does creativity come from? You can say creativity comes from God, for all we know. That's a reasonable enough assumption on my part, I guess.
I saw a hand behind you, Joe.
A couple thoughts. One, I've worked, and I'm sure you have as well, I work closely with graphic designers, illustrators, video, screenwriters, and their jobs are highly technical jobs. I mean, I've watched them use Photoshop. I've seen them use Illustrator. The technicality of all the little vector points is very precise. But as a rule, they understand that you can't be an illustrator unless you're creative. You're X'd out of the whole profession if you're not creative. And then I look at an instructional designer, and these seem to feel like if we're going to be an objective science and legitimate and deserve to be paid and certified, we have to limit ourselves and emphasize the technical aspects of our job. The creative aspects of our job are just as important as they are to, in my mind, the artist who must be bold. But it's almost like, to use a painting analogy, in the medieval times when you painted religious art, everybody had to be elongated and their heads had to be at a 45-degree angle and Peter had to be holding a key, or you weren't doing it right. Right? And then eventually, art opened up the non-scientific technical part of religious art, and you could draw Peter in more appealing ways. Sometimes I wonder if what we're lacking is a failure to understand our role as a larger and maybe even requiring aesthetics and creativity to be successful, rather than if you can do that too, well, good for you, and oh, we don't have time or budget. Well, it's a good thing we can still do
We don't teach that, but we hope you're born with it.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we've already talked about constraints and whether we view creativity as happening with a set of unlimited possibilities or happening within some, you know, Nelson and Stoltzman write about this crucible of, you know, you've got things, you've got boundaries in a particular scenario that you're working in that you do bump up against, and you have to work within that to kind of let that be the pressure cooker that produces a creative idea, hopefully. But, so I think that in, you know, as instructional designers, we have a process that helps us to get a handle on what are the limits of scope and are the constraints of this particular design. And within that, the creative ideas can emerge. But there's a distinction between something that may be really clever or really aesthetically grabbing, but may not further the goals of that particular instructional design project. My contention is that within this context that we're speaking of, the creativity that is really creativity is something that is not only a new idea, but it's also useful or appropriate for that particular context in which you're trying to accomplish your goal. Go ahead.
Mike is still over here. I was hoping you guys could be a little bit more pragmatic, because now that we enter this instructional technology world, it's a lot of putting it up to the street. Actually, I've got a lot swimming in my head right now. A couple weeks ago, I was at Open Ed, or was it a month ago? I was at Open Education, and Ryan Lamb did this really crazy mashup during the keynote that he did. And I keep thinking about the teams I used to work with, and back in Eugene, Oregon, and I think as instructional designers, we have to be creative, because I sit in these classes, in these lecture classes, or just sort of in any of my classes that I'm sitting in, and I just want to bust through these walls that I find myself stuck in during class, because that's the part that I'm going to be interested in. You know, I want to be engaged, and I don't want to have to be talked at, and so I was really hoping you guys would do the pragmatic stuff, because do I think that creativity can be taught? I don't know if it can be taught, but it can be modeled, and you can sort of use the creativity level and know how to reach it. I mean, Brian was amazing, and so I'm actually inspired to see if I can maybe do something that he did or something like that. And so, yeah, I would have liked to see the more pragmatic. Like, what's going on? Why are you guys talking about this? And you guys all look really interesting. I want to know what's going on in your brain to get there, and not just the academic thought.
Well, can I go after you?
Yeah, sure, why not? I thought you were going to say, can I go before you? Yeah. Here's the pragmatic thing. This is just my take off the cuff. That's what you kind of wanted. Creativity is ways of seeing. Right? Creativity is visualizing the world in different ways and then picking from that. And so, if you want to be creative, what you need to do is acquire that skill of being able to see the world in different ways. There's talk about constraints, and that it's kind of like saying, you know, well, the form of the haiku is what creates the haiku. And, like, stated like this, it's nothing personal. It's ridiculous. Right? The form doesn't create the haiku. It's the range of possibilities within that form that are imagined by the person who's writing the haiku, right? So it's, you know, it's like saying the walls that surround the play are what make the play. Well, no, it just means that exit stage left leads to a brick wall, not Serbia, you know. So,
right.
So now,
I don't see any disagreement there.
Yeah, no, there is good. Then, if learning how to be creative is learning how to see the world in different ways, learning how to see the world, then the way to become creative is to see the world as seen in many in as many different ways as possible. In other words, to stretch your range of experience. Again, the talk of constraint. It seems to me that we bring constraints to the table, and that is in fact what stands in the way of our being creative. And how often have we heard that the creative person is the person who saw beyond this constraint that everybody assumed there was? So the mechanism for being creative is to find ways of seeing, experience ways of seeing, where people actually go beyond those constraints.
Well, next, yeah,
modeling.
Sorry, I'm rather taking a turn. It focuses me on the beginning part, the analysis part of the process that we're looking at in instructional design, which also has room for creative ways of looking beyond what someone else may see as a constraint, defining the process. A lot of the definitions that people, that scholars have worked with in creativity includes problem definition. So I think that breaking through constraints is dealt with.
Well, I'm eager to get off the constraint discussion, but I do want to quote, I need to quote you. To be creative is to create.
Yeah,
it's not seen. See, perception is part of creativity, but I think you overstated it a little bit. But I want to get back what I really was hoping Stephen would go off on your comment. I was hoping you'd respond to the openness question. And, you know, Brian Land is a good example of somebody who's not bound by the canon. And but let me just comment on that part of it. I found one of the things we do at conferences is share what we're up to and share the cool things we're finding. And Pat Lay and who pointed that David Long's work to us?
George was at the piano.
Yeah, George. Where's George? George turned us on to a professor at Michigan State named David Wong, W-O-N-G. And he's got some of his papers up on the web, and it converged with my interest very closely, with our interests. And so we're excited to found him. And one of the things that Wong talks about, and what were they going with this?
The Wong way?
I've lost this point about riffing. Oh, I know. Okay, critique of constructivism. Constructivism says put control in the hands of the learner. Right? And so what's the duality? It's teacher control, which we all know and love, but also hate. And that feeling that you described, feeling out of control, where you're stuck in a class, you have no voice, you know, maybe you feel that way in a session where you say, these people up there are jokers, they don't know what they're talking about, and they're not calling on me. And that frustration that can arise, so it's a teacher-controlled, student-controlled duality. And what Wong talks about is, no, it's not about putting the control in the hands of the learner. It's about giving up a little control. It's about taking some risks. It's
right.
About going out and having an adventure. So when Aaron is on his Arctic expedition, you know, going to have an adventure, learning, you know, whatever, is he in the control? Marginally, we hope that there's some element of control in your exploration. But the whole point of exploration is to give up a little control. And that idea kind of struck home with me. And I'm thinking, and relating it to the creativity discussion that we're having now. Creativity is only one term that I'm interested in. There are a whole cluster of things that are that are kind of related to all this. But if you can surrender and submit yourself to a really interesting problem, a really interesting situation, and devote yourself to that, and chase after it, whether you're a teacher or a student, then isn't that exciting? That's what you want out of good instruction. And it goes beyond this notion of I'm seizing control. No, you're not seizing control. You're giving up control. So relating it to your creativity, you can see the connection I'm trying to make there.
I've got a couple other pragmatic answers in terms of, I'll try to be more molecular. I teach creativity. I test people on creativity. And we have made some assumptions about this is what creativity is and what's in nature. And that happens with every other major. It might be right, might be wrong. Can you train people? Can you teach people creativity? I'm not sure. Can you train them to be creative? Yeah. And there's a big difference. I'm not sure if I'm educating these people at all. And that's why I try not to let the dean in my classroom. But I talk to other people in the creativity field, and I say, well, I'm getting about 30% increase over the course of the semester. And they go, oh, yeah. And they fall asleep. It's like, that's just, everybody expects that. That's about what you get. So, yeah, you can train people in terms of being more creative. Do other things count? Do people become creative all by themselves? Not that much. I've tested freshmen, and I've tested seniors in a graphic design program, and they don't really change that much. They sort of get more skilled at what they're doing. They can answer things differently and better in their specific domain. They have more expert knowledge, and they're able to make more things happen because they have more tools at their disposal. So that helps a lot. Do other things make a difference? Yeah. Like, you know, did you eat breakfast? Yeah, that helps. You know, what time of day it is, it helps a lot. 4 o'clock in the afternoon works a lot better to be creative than 6 o'clock in the morning, depending on your age. So it's a real biological function in terms of generating new ideas. So it gets to that level. On the other end, the Stephen's point about being creative is really important. Is that if the first step of being more creative is to be more creative, just start taking steps to do that. You can't do that sitting in a classroom thinking that things aren't working. And the rules you have to give yourself is you have to fix it. And you have to take initiative, walk forward, and that goes for everybody. Be more, don't take initiative. And what I find is that the largest thing that happens in terms of impinging creativity is people are very frightened at failure, and they're very frightened at being embarrassed,
right,
and being frightened at all these other things. And so I say, my class is saying, here's what you get. When somebody asks you what the hell you're doing, you say, oh, this is for a class.
That answers it.
That talks about 95% saying, I'm not drunk. You know, and that takes another 2 or 3%, I'm not on drugs. And then the rest of the people just ignore, and then by the end of the term, they're a little calloused on that, and they say, well, yeah, I can do anything I want. So, yeah.
I just want to ask, because I'm sure everybody, when you started talking, I noticed all the pens go. You test for creativity. Can you give us some examples of what the questions on those tests would be?
General, I actually got the test from Susan Daniels, the panelist who's not here, and I use the Torrance test for creativity. It's a standardized test.
Torrance.
What's that?
Torrance.
Torrance.
Paul Torrance.
Yeah, Torrance. And it's published out of some place in Southern Illinois, and it's heavily scored by some place in Southern Illinois. Because it's basically, they give you a series of challenges that's timed. It's how many ideas can you come up with in 5 minutes for this specific 10 minutes? And then how different are your ideas from your own? And then the last thing is how different are your ideas from everybody else in society? And so they can sort of say, here's about what people could do on this test. Is that exactly what creativity is? Maybe. Now, I was in Europe, and all these guys in Europe are like, you're crazy, that's not testing for creativity. But you Americans don't like that.
Yeah, comment.
Speaking from, again, a real practical point of view, I find that one of the main elements of creativity is desire. I think we're also speaking from a very ethnocentric kind of point of view, because I teach a lot of all females, and they, from some of their cultures, it's not a value. So can any of you address that from an ethnocentric point of view? Like, creativity is not valued in some cultures. In fact, it's frowned upon. I think it's the opposite. I think our culture, we revere creativity, and I think it's one of the things that, that's why we're here, because we're all interested in that. But I think one of the first points is desire. You have to want to be the
Teresa Mabule is one scholar whose name kind of comes to the surface in studying motivation, intrinsic motivation especially, and its role in creative outcomes. So that would be someone possibly to look at. There are also some other researchers that I think of Dean Pete Simonton, who has studied creativity in different cultures and different eras in history. Dean Keith Simonson. He uses a method called historiometric research, and he just gathers tons of data from what's going on, like, for example, in Vienna in the late 19th century or whatever, and factors that are, you know, that lead to more creative work coming out of a particular culture. I'm not sure if I have more, much, you know, as far as looking at another culture where creativity is decidedly not valued.
Well, I think I was in China recently, and Chinese education is famous for being non-student-centered, non-interactive, you know, more lecture-based and that kind of thing. And yet, when I was in Chengdu, I went to Du Fu's garden, and this is a famous poet from 680, 880, I'm bad at history. But this was like a temple. The culture valued this artist as much as they did their religion. And, you know, there were statues of him throughout his garden, and it was one of the most beautiful places I visited while there. So it's, you know, even though the culture extremely values creativity, and I think the same is in ours, when it comes to education, we for some reason think there's no place for it there. It's and I think it's partly what you said, maybe what Mark Prinsky said as well, you know, that in education, we think it's more to deliver information and deliver the canon kind of thing rather than make creative people. I wanted to add one tip. You know, it seems like perhaps you were asking for tools and, you know, ways to be creative in instructional design. And, you know, based on my concern about empathy and use of imagination, you know, I was kind of thinking about this, and who are the best people at exercising empathy? And I would suggest that probably authors of fiction are probably one of the best people. They know how to create characters and embody those characters in their own mind, you know, and, you know, play out what they do. And so instructional designers, I think, can, as they come up with potential solutions, write stories about how those solutions might play out, how students might react, how users of their materials might respond to those materials, what might be the life experience that happens as they go through this instructional experience. And by the process of writing that story, you're being creative, and you're seeing a much richer picture of how this instructional intervention plays out. So there's maybe a practical tool.
And Pat's got a paper on that exact topic, a method called Design Stories, and a paper that he can send you if you ask him on emails. Seriously, if you like that idea of creating an empathic scenario story as a design method to kind of understand how your materials might play out, contact him because he's done that work.
It was in Tech Trends last year or something.
That's right. We have run out of time, and I'm so thankful to all of you for coming and being part of this. I just think maybe one thing to mention in closing that plays off of the idea Brent had to highlight Pat's work is there are some other sessions yet to come in the conference that deal more with the theme of creativity. I'm thinking of mine, particularly, which is at 115 today, which is my dissertation research, working with graduate students in their design projects. Are there any others, or am I just thinking Eagle Secret PD?
The workshop tomorrow morning.
Yes, Brad has a 3-hour workshop on being more creative tomorrow morning, 8 to 11, right? And he teaches a full semester of this at, you know, at a time. So he knows what he's doing. So there's pragmatic.
And I'm about to run to a session that I'm delivering with Luca Vittori on applying aesthetic principles in instructional
design. Yes. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.